From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Black Lives Matter movement in the United States shone a spotlight on the violence of the state on primarily Black bodies at the hands of law enforcement. While much has been written about police violence and the carceral state, few have connected explicitly that the police state is directly linked to our system of capitalism. My guest, William Robinson, writes in his new book, Savage Global Inequalities Are Politically Explosive, and to the extent that the system is simply unable to incorporate surplus humanity, it turns to ever more violent forms of containment. William I. Robinson is a professor of sociology, global studies, and Latin American studies at UC Santa Barbara. His earlier books include Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, and We Will Not Be Silenced. He joins me to talk about his newest book called simply The Global Police State. Welcome to the program, William.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So when you describe the global police state, it is far broader than just the officers that we see on our streets in the United States. It's police all over the world, but it's also other forms of state authority that uses force to basically control the population, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we want to understand global police state, we really need to understand the crisis of global capitalism, and particularly two dimensions. And one is the economic or structural dimension. The global economy has been facing ever deeper chronic stagnation, and global police state is a response to that stagnation, which I can explain in a moment. But also global capitalism is in this deep political crisis of state legitimacy and capitalist hegemony. And both of these dimensions of global state police state have to need to be seen as linked to in unprecedented global inequalities. I'm sure that the listeners and the viewers are familiar with this data that 1% of humanity controls over 50% of the world's wealth, and more significantly, 20% of humanity, and that figure is shrinking, controls 95% of the world's wealth. That means that 80% of humanity has just 5% of the world's wealth and faces crisis of survival and death. So the ruling groups are extending a global police state in order to contain the real, the actual, and the potential rebellion of surplus humanity and this downwardly mobile, destabilized global working class. That's really where the story starts. So what I mean by global police state are three things. First, we see an incredible extension and deepening all around the world. And Portland is just, it's on display in Portland in the United States, but this is just the U.S., just in the United States, worldwide, the incredible extending and deepening of systems of transnational social control and repression and militarization. That's the first thing I mean, in order to contain rebellion, real and the global revolt from below. The second dimension, though, of global police state, and this is what is critical, is that in the face of the chronic stagnation in the global economy, these systems of warfare, social control, and repression are enormously profitable, and they're expanding rapidly. Transnational corporate capital, what I call the transnational capitalist class, is deeply invested in global police state and extending that investment as a way simply of accumulating capital and making profit in the face of stagnation and other aspects of the global economy. And the third thing I mean by global police state is that we're seeing worldwide, and of course this is on the verge of this danger right in the United States, is the shift towards political systems that can be characterized as 21st century fascism. And we need to see, I really think the concept of global police state really helps us get a grip on what's going on worldwide this moment that we are in right now. And we need to see how these three dimensions of global police state are intertwined in a way that signals this new and extremely dangerous moment in global capitalism as the world descends into this repressive totality.
How do liberal elites explain the crisis in capitalism with wealth inequality so staggering globally, but even in the United States under the pandemic, we've seen it worsen with the wealthiest Americans and corporations seeing their wealth balloon because of the pandemic? How do liberal elites who defend the system explain it?
Well, they don't give, they absolutely don't give a structural explanation. They absolutely don't critique global capitalism. The liberal elite have been pushing and developing global capitalism, neoliberal global capitalism for four decades now. And it's the liberal elite which has pushed us into this global police state.
Hence neoliberal to describe them.
Absolutely. It's a mistake to see the global police state is just these far-right fascist forces, such as Trumpism in the United States, for instance. The global police state has been developing for several decades now with the unleashing of capitalist globalization, neoliberal capitalist globalization, in the late 20th century. So this is not specifically a fascist project at all. I mean, and some sectors of the liberal elite, and some of this I discuss in the book, along with this wealth of data on global police state, are increasingly concerned about inequality, but not because of, they are concerned with social justice, but because inequality is so escalating that it's threatening a global revolt that will overthrow the entire system. In fact, let me just read a couple of quotes which dramatically show the concern of the liberal elite, the transnational capitalist class, with this unprecedented inequality. One is that John Rupert, he's the CEO of the biggest and most elite jeweler company, multi-billion dollar jewel company in the world, Cartier. And he said a year or so ago in an interview that he can't get to sleep at night. Every single night he's worried about the poor rising up. And he's also worried about and overthrowing the system. He's also worried about global inequalities because it shrinks the market and also middle and high consumption sectors will be scared to purchase the upscale jewelry because then they'll be targeted by the poor in this revolt. So that's Rupert. And one other quote here, you know, that shows how the liberal elite is so terrified about a global revolt, so terrified that they're pushing global police state. And this is the editor of the Financial Times in London explaining an interview that several interviews that he did with billionaires around the world. He writes, "One thing I've been hearing from a lot of wealthy people these days since US election of in 2016 of Donald Trump is that they all have escape plans. Rich people are buying up ranches in New Zealand and creating bunkers in the Bahamas or wherever they're going. They're thinking that somehow they're going to be able to avoid the apocalypse when it comes. That's actually a business that operates in, there's a business that operates in New York. It's a boat that will come. You can apparently pre-buy tickets. If there's some political crisis or some danger moment, they'll come and pick you up and whisk you up the Hudson." You know, so here we see the liberal elite to which you're referring is terrified about global revolt. And at the same time, remember, the liberal elite represents the interests of transnational corporate capital. And global police state is big business for the
right.
transnational capitalist class.
I want to get to that aspect of it. But in a moment, you use the term surplus humanity in your book quite a bit. What do you mean by surplus humanity?
Yes, that global capitalism has been in a process of transformation and restructuring for several decades now, driven by two things. One is capitalist globalization, and the second thing is the increasing technological level and computer and information technology, digital technology. It's transforming the whole global economy, and it is increasingly pushing out and making surplus and irrelevant to the system ever more larger swathes of humanity. So the International Labor Organization reported just a few years ago that one third of humanity is unemployed and structurally marginalized from the global economy. 2 billion people are forced to scratch out a living or not to survive in the informal economy in every way they can. And 1.3 billion workers, and that actually went up to 1.5 billion, the most recent report, out of a global working class of 3 billion people are in precarious work arrangements in which survival is uncertain. So you have these two sectors of the mass of humanity, that 80%, and it's even more than 80%. You have surplus humanity locked out that needs to be contained and repressed by global police states. And then you have the mass of working people, people that actually have jobs, but precarious jobs in which they can't survive. I mean, the United States, we know that very well, but this is worldwide. And they too need to be disciplined and repressed. So that means that's the condition of 80% of humanity. And this is deepening as global capitalism continues to restructure, especially through digitalization and the pandemic that we're in. See, the pandemic did not cause the crisis. It just intensified it many times over. But the other thing happening in the pandemic is that the process of digitalization, which throws people into surplus humanity, de-skills people and throws them into precarious arrangements, is rapidly accelerating through the pandemic itself.
So the business of policing, if you will, is quite lucrative. And unsurprisingly, those who sit at the top of the wealth inequality pyramid have found a way to capitalize off of that as well. It sort of nicely feeds in on itself. What are these tools of policing that are so lucrative, and how lucrative are they?
Absolutely. Well, there's a wealth of data, of course, in the book. Here's just a few examples. And September 11, 2001 was a turning point in the sense that it allowed the ruling groups to bring about a much more sweeping militarization of the whole global economy and society, to really put in place a global war economy.
And here in the U.S., that was the Patriot Act, USA Patriot Act.
Well, exactly. But there were some 180 countries around the world passed similar repressive legislation. But the Pentagon budget increased from 1998 to 2011 by 98%. 98%. Worldwide military spending increased by 50% in this period. And this is just official state military spending. It doesn't include secret state budgets, police budgets, intelligence, homeland security budgets. I've estimated that if we put all of this state military and spending on military and repressive systems, you're talking about 5 to 6% of the global GDP, the global economy. And that, in addition, does not include private corporate spending on military and repression. There are 20 million private police in the world. In one half of the countries in the world, they number more than official public police forces. There are 15 million people in the world that work now for what's called private military firms. And those private military firms are operating to defend and expand corporate influence and control and repress people in every continent in the world. The biometrics industry, and this is taking off even more in the pandemic, is now worth $35 billion and expected to go up in the next few years to hundreds of billions of dollars. There are now 200 private prisons on every continent in the world, and the fastest, and prisoners, the prison population is growing rapidly over the world as global police state represses people, criminalizes them, and locks them up. But increasingly, they're going into private prisons, which is not just a U.S. phenomenon. The European Union unleashed a border security program about 10, 12 years ago, especially right after the Arab Spring uprisings of 2010, 2011, and not because they were threatened by poor refugees and immigrants, but because this was a new form of accumulating capital and spending money. And so spending for border security in the European Union increased an unbelievable 3,688% from 2005 to 2016. And all of that spending on border security is in private transnational corporations. The states simply turn that money over to the corporations. There's also, listen to this, there's also a rising multi-billion dollar global riot control industry all over the world. Here is a dramatic quote. This is from the Lloyd's of London report. They write, instances of political violence contagion are becoming more frequent and headed towards political violence pandemics. Super strains of political violence include anti-imperialist and independence movements, social movements calling for removal of an occupying force, mass pro-reform protests against national governments, armed insurrections inspired by Marxism. Then the report goes on to say that the global riot control system, therefore, is going to be a booming business for transnational corporations. So I could go on and on. Of course, there's this wealth of data in the book, but that gives you an idea of some of how global police state, its expansion and extension around the world is deepening, becomes immensely profitable at a time when the global economy is in, now it's in depression, but has been facing chronic stagnation for quite a number of years.
And I want to get to the part of your book that discusses the pushback against this global police state. But I'm wondering if you can apply some of your analysis to what's happening in the United States right now, considering how the Black Lives Matter movement just over the past several months catapulted onto an international stage the inequality and the racist violence of policing. How do you apply your analysis to the fact that Black Americans are disproportionately targeted? And a lot of this policing is happening in cities run by Democrats, a weakness that President Trump gleefully points out.
Right. Well, they're in cities, and it's very important to say that because the global megacities, there's mega cities of 10, 15, 20 million people all over the world, and more than half of the world's population now lives in these megacities, and those are the sites of global police state, but they're also the leading sites of the revolt against global capitalism, against inequality, against the pushback against global police state. As far as the
what do you mean by the mega cities? Are they cities like New York City and Los Angeles, the big metropolitan cities?
New York, right, in the United States, New York City and Los Angeles, but we're talking about all over the world, Jakarta, San Paulo, and Rio, the big global, Mumbai, all over the world, the big the majority of the population are now in these giant cities. At Shanghai, for instance, Shanghai is the leading edge of the upsurge in working class struggles in China, for instance. But the population has moved into cities. It's 51 to 52% a few years ago. It's going to be up in the next up to 60-70% of the world's population. And in these cities, we see extreme inequality. We see spatial and social apartheid. Of course, in some countries such as the United States, this takes an incredibly racialized dimension. And it's here where global police state is unleashed. But you were asking about the Democrats, and I want to stress this, just as I was pointing out that it's not just the fascists and far right which is pushing global police state, but to the contrary, the liberal elites. The same thing in the United States. Democrat or Republicans are deeply invested in defending global capitalism from a revolt from below, and they've been deeply invested in neoliberal capitalist globalization that has generated this inequality, this escalation of inequality to begin with, and they have pushed military budgets and systems of repression and so forth and so on. So this is not partisan in the United States. Now, you were asking, currently in the United States, the leading edge of the mass revolt, but not at all limited to it, is the BLM-led anti-racist uprising. But the global revolt has been picking up steam since the turn of the century, and then 2008 was a turning point that led to a mass upsurge in protests and organization and resistance worldwide. We know that. And now in 2016, 2017, this escalates even further. We want to remember that right before the pandemic, the global revolt, fall of 2019 was the worldwide spring of global revolts. Remember Chile, remember Lebanon, remember Iraq, remember the Yellow Vest movement in France, remember in India. In India, there was a strike in 2019 of 250 million workers. That was the largest worker strike in the history of humanity, of the planet. And so the current ups, and then this is all intensified, of course, and under new terrain with the pandemic. But we want to remember the global police state is reactive. We might feel, you know, helpless sometimes in the face of this, of the powers from above and how they beat down on us, but it is reacting to the global revolt and to the possibility of fundamental challenge to global capitalism and even to revolution. But I want to add one other point there, because I think this is very important. Obviously, every single progressive militantly supports the current anti-racist uprising in the United States, myself included. I was in the streets here in Los Angeles early in the uprising. But we're seeing there's one problem with this global revolt, and we're seeing this juncture in the sense that social movements and resistance is proliferating worldwide. And yet an organized left, a socialist left, an anti-capitalist left is very underdeveloped and very weak. And they have not linked together. The socialist and, you know, left has not given a leadership to these rebellions all over the world. And I think that's a weakness that we have to think about if we talk about resistance. And also the organized workers movement, trade union movements, they're picking up steam worldwide, but they are still historically weak. And so I think if we're going to face down and beat back global police state, we need a triangulation of these mass social movements, including, of course, the anti-racist movement in the United States, but the 1,000 different faces of all these mass social movements. They need to link up with an organized left, that we have to get our act together there, and they need to link up together with the workers and union, trade union and worker struggles. So you have this triangulated resistance to global capitalism ultimately, but in the immediately to global police state and this repression.
And of course, there is a racialized aspect to the issue of workers' rights. We know that workers of color are disproportionately affected. Here in the U.S., there's a microcosm of that during the pandemic. And we also, of course, see capitalism in general disproportionately impacting people of color, the criminal justice system, police system disproportionately impacting people of color. All of that can even, you know, people have written history histories about why that is the case, and that goes back to the history of institutions of slavery, et cetera, that are very much part of the origins of capitalism. So in terms of what you're seeing happening with totalitarian and authoritarian states, is there a coming together of the neoliberal elitists who like to distinguish themselves from the right-wing authoritarianisms? Is there a coming together of these two forces that claim to be different and that are in many ways different, but seem to be invested together in the global police state?
Yes. Well, you know, we're at a moment, and this is a good situation for us resisting from below and fighting back against global police state and, again, against global capitalism, because global police state is a response to the crisis of global capitalism. We want to remember that. But there's really, at this moment, and we haven't seen this in a long time, incredible splits and fissures and disagreements among the ruling groups worldwide. And if we could say in very simplified form, you know, how can we characterize this? There's the far-right fascists, which are gaining ground dangerously all over the world. I mean, Trumpism in the United States, but this Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil, all of these neo-fascist and far-right authoritarian parties and organizations in Eastern and Western Europe. We know all of that. So that's one fraction of the ruling groups and ruling groups. The second is the neoliberals, business as usual, neoliberal capitalist globalization as usual. And for the moment, that's Biden-Harris, you know, here in the United States. We need to be clear about that. They are not fascist, these neoliberal business as usual section of the global ruling classes, but their pursuit of neoliberalism, of capitalist globalization, of transnational corporate profit and control is fueling the social base of fascist response to the crisis. Then the third group, to, you know, in response to your question, is what I call in that book the reformist wing, the global reformers, and they are acknowledging that the incredible inequalities, the threat of fascism, the threat of a collapse of democracy is really going to threaten global capitalism in the long run. So their project is to save capitalism from itself by mild reforms, such as some redistribution through renewed, resurrected social programs and more progressive taxation.
Of the kind that Bernie Sanders was probably offering, who's really considered a reformist if you look at historical attempts to address capitalism's failures.
Yes, Bernie Sanders and, of course, Corbyn in England. But even more than that, there's other intellectual and spokespeople and pundits for this reformist wing, for instance, in the Davos group in Switzerland, figures that are very often in the media in the United States, such as Joseph Stiglitz, Jeffrey Sachs. So this is that reformist wing, but it is very weak. And one of the things going on is that transnational corporate capital, what I call the transnational capitalist class, particularly concentrated in global finance capital in the financial conglomerates, in the banks, but also in Silicon Valley, in the military-industrial complex, their power, the power of global financial markets and the global investor class is so powerful that so far it has been able to dictate that this reformist project is not going anywhere worldwide. Now, that can and must change as part of our struggles from below. We need to think about class and political alliances with reformist wings of the ruling elite without letting them exercise hegemony over our struggles for more radical transformation, for more radical social justice, for more of a redistribution of power and wealth downward. But we definitely need to be building an anti-fascist united front, as everyone's talking about. I called for that in the book. I go into a lot of historical and theoretical detail on this new threat of 21st century fascism. But we want to not sacrifice the popular agenda, the demands that we have from below, as we enter into political and class and alliances with these reformist wings of the global ruling classes.
William, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate you packing so much information into a short conversation. And of course, the book is a much lengthier, filler of some of these issues. Thanks so much. And good luck to you with the book.
Thanks so much for having me on.
My guest has been William I. Robinson, professor of sociology, global studies, and Latin American studies at UC Santa Barbara. He's the author of several books, including Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, and We Will Not Be Silenced. We've been talking about his newest book, The Global Police State. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.